is the Tom Hartmann Program.
Welcome back. Tom Hartmann here with you. Just checking out. I used to have this site, nobillionaires.com, and don't think it's been updated. And yeah, it's apparently not working. Anyhow, we have a media problem in this country right now, and it's tied into our oligarchy problem. Jim Narekas from FAIR, Fairness and Accuracy in Reporting, is writing about this over at alternet.org. And he notes, you know, the announcement that Time magazine would be bought by software CEO Mark Benioff highlighted the growing trends of billionaires buying up media outlets. You got Rupert Murdoch, you know, who owns Fox and New York Post and the Wall Street Journal, flying down to L.A., again, going through the United Clubs, they call them, United Clubs. The only newspapers they have now are Wall Street Journals. And they're giving them away for free to all the people who are wealthy enough to fly and have club memberships and stuff. And it's like, whoa, you know. Anyhow, Michael Bloomberg, with Bloomberg Media, Donald Newhouse, Newhouse Media, Forbes on their list of the world's billionaires. But then they get into Pierre Omidyar and Steve Jobs' widow, Lorene Powell Jobs, are looking at media. Mort Zuckerman, the real estate, New York real estate billionaire, owned The Atlantic from 80 to 99, The Daily News from 93 to 2017. He still owns U.S. News and World Report, which he bought in 84. And, these guys are kind of the modern-day Citizens Kane. Oh, nobillionaires.com just came up. How cool. Hashtag nobillionaires. So, Shelley Adelson bought a newspaper in Las Vegas. He also owns the largest newspaper in Israel, which is given away for free. And, of course, it represents Shelley Adelson's hardcore right-wing views and is incredibly supportive of Netanyahu. Jeff Bezos bought the Washington Post. And one of the things that you just basically never see covered in these things is the problem of extraordinary wealth being aggregated at the top and how that corrupts society. In other words, the problem of oligarchy. We are not discussing in this country the problem of oligarchy. And it's why I did the nobillionaires.com website. And the case against the billionaires. You know, it's time as a nation that we have a serious discussion about outlawing billionaires. I put this website up in 2012. 2012 was one heck of a year for the billionaires. The 100 richest people in the world got $241 billion wealthier, bringing their total net worth to $1.9 trillion. These 100 people have more combined wealth than the entire GDP of nations like Italy, Mexico, Spain, Canada, Australia, and about 170 other nations. Billionaires exclusive to the U.S. also had a field day, as the annual Forbes 400 showed America's richest billionaires saw their wealth increase by $200 billion last year, bringing their total net worth to $1.7 trillion. You know, and at the same time, 49 million Americans still living in poverty. So, what do we do? I mean, you know, I don't think that the way to solve this problem is to say billionaires can't buy media. I think the way to solve, because the problem is much deeper and more systemic than that. Thomas Piketty, really brilliantly laid it out in his book Capital, and others have, you know, since that time. David K. Johnston writes about it very eloquently. There's a number of others. I've written about it. My book Screwed is all about this. The right-wing attempts to basically screw the middle class and move all that money into the hands of the very, very rich. We were talking, Chauncey DeVega and I, in the last hour, talking about the study that came out of Northwestern University by Page and Gillens, in which they found that the desires of the top 5% were regularly enacted into law. My recollection is it was 74% of the time. I could be off on that. I'm doing it from memory. But, it was noticeable and measurable, whereas the desires of the bottom 95%, not so much. You know, the probability of the average person's political desires being, strengthen Social Security, raise the minimum wage, whatever it may be, the probability of that being translated into law is equal to random noise. So my solution to this is to raise taxes. To raise taxes on the very, very wealthy back to where they were before Reagan first cut them in, I believe it was 82 or 83, his first big tax cut, where he took the top rate from 74%. It followed over several, there were several of these, but it started at 74%, the top tax rate. And at that point in time, the average CEO took home less than 30 times the average worker. And Reagan dropped that top rate, and we had a couple of billionaires. I mean, you know, Bill Gates was there, Warren Buffett was there, but they were the exceptions rather than the rule. You had some people who were very, very wealthy, you know, the Koch brothers, very, very wealthy, but not just, you know, explosively, obscenely, morbidly rich. And then Reagan dropped that top tax rate from 74% down to 25%, and then it bounced back up a little bit. And, you know, Trump just cut it again. And that top tax rate is what protects us from oligarchy. It is a political stabilizer. And I would argue emphatically that the main reason why over the last, what, roughly 50 years, has it been? 40 years? Since 1980? Yeah, it's been about 40 years. Since Reagan, essentially. That during that period of time, the reason why our society and our politics have become so badly corrupted by just a whole cacophony of chaos. And, you know, the Tea Party coming out, no, you know, tax us less and, you know, cut taxes and Grover Norquist and all this, and the loss of our public schools falling apart, our infrastructure falling apart, people being poisoned all over the country. It's not just Flint, although Flint is among the worst. And again, Michael Moore's movie is just brilliant in this regard, Fahrenheit 11/9. But most of that is, according to Richard Wilkinson and Kate Pickett, who wrote two books. One was called Why Inequality Matters, and the other is called The Spirit Level. And they've got a substantial and robust website around this too, which you can, you know, easily find with a DuckDuckGo search. The reason why things have fallen apart so badly is that as economic inequality increases, as working class and poor people get less income, and as the very rich get more income and wealth, as that happens, there's this whole spectrum of social ills that explode on the scene. One of the things that Wilkinson and Pickett did is they literally went country by country around the world with the OECD countries, the 34 OECD countries, and then they went state by state with all 50 U.S. states. And you can see the graphs and charts on their website and in their book, The Spirit Level, which is just brilliant and really worth buying. And what you see is that whether it's comparing states to states, you know, Louisiana to California, or whether it's comparing Denmark to the U.S. or the U.K., that those countries, principally the United States and the United Kingdom, who followed Reagan and Thatcher's economic and political advice and unleashed the billionaires, have seen an explosion of this whole spectrum of social ills, from things like sexually transmitted diseases, teenage pregnancies, rape, violent, assault, murder, suicide, the number of people taking both illegal and psychoactive legally prescribed drugs, alcoholism and deaths from alcoholism, traffic accidents as a consequence of alcoholism. I'm sorry, I don't have the list in front of me, but there's about 30 of these things on this list, and they measurably go up as inequality increases. I mean, it's just that simple. As inequality increases, they measurably go up. As inequality decreases, these social ills measurably go down. And I would add to that list billionaires buying media. And it's like, hey, you know, I've got $100 billion. I should do something. Well, by the Washington Post. I would do it if I was Jeff Bezos. But as a society, we have to ask ourselves this question. is the price that we pay for having billionaires among us so low that we're willing to continue doing it? Or is the price so high, so many literally million, 49 million people living in poverty, is it so high, is that price so high, that it's time to say that we're going to start seriously taxing all income over $1 billion, and we're going to raise the top tax rate on people making over, you know, $2 to $3 million a year, back up to 74%. I realize, you know, there are Democrats, you know, who are saying, oh, you can't talk like that, you know, you'll never win elections. I think we will. I absolutely think we will. Franklin Roosevelt did it. I'll share some of FDR's thoughts on taxes with you after this break, and we can continue the conversation. Stick around. We'll be right back. It's 17 minutes past the hour.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
It's the place where smart people get their news. We'll be right back. And welcome back. Morris in Long Beach, California. Hey, Morris, thanks for listening to KPFK. What's up?
Yes, Professor, listen, it's kind of rough, in my humble opinion, to impeach a United States president. But what about impeaching a sitting Chief Justice of the Supreme Court? I think that might be a little bit easier to do. Kavanaugh is going to be approved, in my humble opinion, because we are in a misogynistic environment. The president himself is of the same spirit. I believe he's going to be approved. But when the elections take place, and there is this blue wave, which I anticipate, I'm in agreement with that. I think the first step should be not impeaching Donald Trump, but go after those chief justices on the Supreme Court. You start with Kavanaugh, and then you go with Thomas, and then you go with Roberts. And you get the Me Too movement now. You get the Me Too movement to do this because they want to protect themselves against the turning over of the Roe v. Wade. Okay, so they got to be the ones that are leading this movement. And let me end by saying this, Professor. I got this from a book called White Protestant Nation, The Rise of the American Conservative Movement in This Country. Whenever you talk about a conservative, or whenever you're talking about a libertarian, you're talking about a godless people that only believe in cosmic materialism. They believe that religious faith is the worst curse of mankind. Just to give you an idea of who we're dealing with. So these people have no souls. So anyway, let's just go after these chief justices, impeach them. I think that's a lot easier than taking out a president. Thanks, Professor.
You're welcome. Morris, I hope that works. It's the same, you know, problem that you have with impeaching a president. You can do it with a simple majority. You can pass the impeachment resolution with a simple majority, or the articles of impeachment with a simple majority in the House of Representatives. But in the Senate, you need 2/3 of the vote. And that's going to be a really heavy lift. But your point is very well taken, and thank you very much for it. Bill, watching Free Speech TV in Beaverton, Oregon. Hey, Bill, what's up?
Hi, thank you. I think when Trump pulled out of the Paris Accords, Europe should have turned around and imposed tariffs, maybe even boycotted U.S. goods because they're not complying with the standards, you know, that are necessary.
Yeah, they didn't do that because, you know, the money talks, right? I get what you're saying. And the other point, by the way, is that Trump says he took us out of the Paris Accords, but we're actually still in them until December. I don't know it's December of this year or the last December of his term in office. I think it's the last December of his term in office. I think that you know, thing lasted for a certain number of years. And so basically, Trump can't stop it. He can simply say we're not going to renew it or continue to participate in it. But he's also, you know, reached out to all of his different, federal government agencies, cabinet agencies, whatnot, and, you know, got them messing with, you know, we've taken climate change off the EPA website and stuff like that, Interior Department. And Bill, thank you for the call. I don't think that Europe is going to save us. We've got to save ourselves. I mean, we can look to Europe for all kinds of things, you know, great examples and you know, what to do and what not to do in a whole variety of different areas. But, you know, even if they were to impose punitive sanctions on us around the issue of, the Paris Accords, still, you know, we've got to save ourselves. We'll be right back. It's 21 minutes past the hour. Go to tomhartman.com/podcast. Welcome back. I was talking about taxes and how we need to be raising taxes. And I just want to share a little Franklin Roosevelt with you. And this is out of the 360, Sean. He had a lot to say about this back in the day. When he came into office, you'll recall in 1920, Warren Harding ran on the campaign of dropping the top tax rate from the high 70% down to 20%, which he did, and which led to the Roaring Twenties. You know, it super juiced the economy, and then the crash of 1928, and so or 1929 actually, October of 29, and after the election of 28, which Hoover got elected president. Republican prosperity, right? It's a great thing. And then 3 years of the Great Crash, and along comes FDR, and he says, you know, we're going to raise taxes. We're going to do away with the oligarchic class, or we're going to not do away with them, but we're going to restrain their power, and we're going to raise taxes. And here's FDR talking about taxes.
Taxes, after all, are the dues that we pay for the privilege of membership in an organized society. And as society becomes more civilized, government, national and state and local, is called on to assume more obligations to its citizens. The privileges of membership in a civilized society have vastly increased in modern times. But I am afraid we have many who still do not recognize their advantages and want to avoid paying their dues.
There you go. And then he continues the rant.
On the one hand, there has been a vast majority of citizens who believe that the benefits of democracy should be extended and who are willing to pay their fair share to extend them. And on the other hand, there has been a small but powerful group which has fought the extension of these benefits because it did not want to pay a fair share of their costs.
And from there, FDR takes it. I mean, he's developing this argument, and the American people were with him. They loved it that FDR raised taxes.
Our present emergency and a common sense of decency.
That would be World War II.
Make it imperative that no new group of war millionaires shall come into being in this nation as a result of the struggles abroad. The American people will not relish the idea of any American citizen growing rich and fat in an emergency of blood and slaughter and human suffering.
Now, at that point in time, he had already raised taxes. But so let's get back to his rants on taxes. Here's another one.
But you would think, to hear some people talk, that those good people who live at the top of our economic pyramid are being taxed into rags and tatters. But what is the fact? The fact is that they are much further away from the poorhouse than they were in 1932. And you and I know that as a matter of personal observation.
Yeah, and I would say we're there right now as well. I mean, this is the situation, and this is the conversation we need to have.
Friends who belong in these very high upper brackets have suggested to me on several occasions of late that if I am re-elected president, they will have to move to some other nation because of high taxes here. Now, I will miss them very much.
And notice the response of the people. I mean, you know, it's like I hear from people who say, oh, you can't advocate raising taxes. You know, Democrats can't get elected on that. Franklin Roosevelt got elected. He got reelected three times. He was elected president of the United States four times in a row. And that was like the core of his platform. So we've got a media problem in this country. We've got a bunch of billionaires who are buying up media properties for fun or for politics or all of the above. How do you solve it? Raise their taxes. We'll be back.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Call 202-808-9925.
And by the way, if you raise their taxes, you'll have money that you can use to rebuild our schools and replace, you know, Flint's lead pipes and all kinds of good stuff. So much going on. Rod Rosenstein is still in, at least until Thursday. There are protests planned all around the country. Trump is not above the law.org is the website for that. It's a coalition. We had Stephen from Common Cause on earlier this morning talking about it. We've got my proposal for, no more billionaires, or let's reduce the power and wealth of the billionaires anyway. Good luck with that, right, in the Citizens United world where they can own politicians as well as newspapers. And Michael Avenatti has just tweeted in the last hour or so that he has a new client and that his new client is credible, who is making an accusation against Brett Kavanaugh. And he says, warning, my client regarding Kavanaugh has previously done work within the State Department, the U.S. Mint, and the Department of Justice. She has been granted multiple security clearances in the past, including public trust and secret. The GOP and others better be very careful in trying to suggest that she is not credible. And, if Michael Avenatti got together with Ronan Farrow, it would be pretty amazing. Paul in Lucerne, California. Hey, Paul, what's on your mind today?
Hey, Tom.
Hey, Paul.
Yes, the president can do that.
Apparently. Yeah.
Yeah. Under the 2012 presidential order that President Barack Obama signed.
Are you talking about suspending elections?
Yes. And I'm talking about all kinds of stuff. They can draft us and make us work. They can draft people.
The draft has been there all along.
But no. This is... not.
I mean, even Lincoln didn't suspend elections during the Civil War, you know?
Yeah, not average citizens who put them in work camp, not make the whole town leave. Bush signed all these executive orders. Barack Obama did away with them. But in 2012, he re-signed them and redid them. There's a great article about it by Jim Garrison, Huffington Post, 2012, when it first happened.
Mm-hmm.
I'll tell you exactly when it was published. Hold on, let me look it up real quick.
Hey, Paul, if you could just tweet it to me with a link, I'd appreciate it. That's the easiest way to get information to me is to tweet it. Tweet it at me. Okay.
All right. I got the link right here.
Cool. Thanks, Lights. Tom_Hartman. Be sure you get that's the business one. Paul, thank you very much for the call or the one for the show.
Thank you.
I appreciate it. Good to hear from you. Kim in Portland. Hey, Kim, thanks for listening to X-Ray FM. And thanks again to Jefferson Smith for doing a marvelous job filling in for me last week. And he, of course, helps run X-Ray FM. Kim, what's up?
Hi, Tom. Well, I have a solution for the billionaires. I would like to propose a moral rebalancing act that strips everything above $25 million from anybody until poverty in America is eradicated. And then after we've eradicated poverty, you could take the cap off and let people start to, build crazy wealth again, but only as long as there remains no active poverty among American citizens.
See, I don't even think you'd have to go that low. I think if you simply capped wealth, personal wealth, at $1 billion or $999 million, that you would have enough money left over to eliminate poverty in the United States and to rebuild our infrastructure, put our country back together, and the billionaires would still have a lot of money.
Rich people. I agree.
I'm not calling for the Bolshevik Revolution here.
Right.
I'm just saying we need to go, let's make America great again, right? Let's go back to the tax system that we had from 1933 until 1983, roughly, and that, during that, what would that be, a 50-year period, or what? I can't do math in my head that fast, but whatever it is, 40-year period, 50-year period, that we had the greatest prosperity in the history of our country, or one of those periods, and it was a sustained prosperity for the middle class. The middle class was, getting wealthy faster than the obscenely rich were. So, I'm with you. Kim, thank you. That's an excellent suggestion. Absolutely excellent suggestion. Corky in Hilton, New York. Hey, Corky, what's on your mind today? Corky, you're on the air. No Corky. That's unusual. Let's try Marie in north of San Antonio, Texas. Hey, Marie, what's on your mind today?
Hey, Tom. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
I just wanted to put this out there. Senator Grassley is, what, 84 years old or around that age? And Senator Hatch, how old is he?
He's old enough that
they
he...
actually able to, you know, be at this hearing? How do they even know what sexual assault is? I mean, I did the math. When 1951, when Senator Grassley or Hatch were coming into age as men, birth control wasn't even legal.
Right.
And these men are now sitting on this Senate Judiciary Committee or whatever, and I don't even know what they know about sexual assault.
Yeah.
And, you know, federal employees have to take a course so they legally say that they have been talked to about sexual assault. But sometimes some of these people that don't want to take the test even have their staff sit in and take it for them.
Hmm.
So I want them to prove beyond a shadow of a doubt that they know exactly what they're talking about. How can they accuse somebody of sexual assault when they might have a completely different idea of what it is?
Yeah, yeah.
I mean,
it's,
you know,
yeah, it is.
1951, come on.
Oh, yeah, it's a completely different generation, and some of us are old enough to remember what it was like back then. It's a very different world right now. I think a lot of these old Republican guys in the Senate, Chuck Grassley in particular, and thank you, Marie, for your comments. They're still living in that world. I mean, they're still living in that madman world, you know. Jeff in San Francisco, listening on AM 910. Hey, Jeff, what's up?
You know, we were talking about taxes, and I was wondering, I'm thinking locally, what's the power of cities such as San Francisco to tax all these, you know, trillion-dollar companies, basically?
Mm.
I heard Richard Wolff talk one time about how London was taxing companies, or it might have been England, to sell their products inside their in England or London. It was either or.
Mm-hmm.
Can cities do that? Like the Board of Supervisors, you know, come together and say, "Hey, we need some money. These guys have tons of money. They take so much out of traffic and, you know, all the resources they use. They need to give something back, and we set up a special tax for that." I mean,
they can and they do, Jeff. It's a very delicate balancing act, though. You know, if your municipal taxes go up to a point that businesses and wealthy individuals consider unreasonable, then they just start moving out of town. And, you know, whereas that's why it has to be done at a federal level.
I don't see them leaving here. That's the thing.
Well, probably not. Seattle's has been really struggling with this. You know, with the explosion in the cost of living there as a result of the double whammy of Microsoft and Amazon. And I think that's a piece of the solution, Jeff. But and thank you for the call and for weighing in on it. But I think the really important piece of it is the federal tax level. Teresa in Philadelphia, you wanted to get back to Judge Kavanaugh's trials and tribulations, or the trials and tribulations that he put a number of women through, apparently.
Exactly. You know what? I was raped when I was 16, and then again when I was 18 when I joined the military, and I never told anybody. And for like 40 years, not until recently, did I tell anybody. Back then, for one thing, there was a stigma.
Right.
If you said you were raped, even your fellow friends would say, "Oh my God, what a horror! And what did you do to
deserve
that?" And you know what? So they were the victim. You weren't. You were the ones that instigated it. So I'm sure I'm not alone in this. I'm sure there are millions of women in this country who have been assaulted and never. I didn't even tell my best friend,
yeah.
Not my family, nobody.
I think it's on the order of, you know, one in three women, or maybe the number's even higher than that, and one in four men is the one that sticks in my head. But But so your suggestion, Teresa, is that the Kavanaugh hearings are not sympathetic to women because of the age and perspective of the men, the Republican men on the panel. It's at the bottom.
Well, you know, that's what they're saying. You know, they're very not sympathetic to her, and they won't even give her a fair hearing and witnesses. You know what? If you're on trial, you get witnesses. So,
yeah.
You know what? Millions of women can come there, and we can testify that, you know what? We didn't tell anybody for a lot of years either.
No, it's absolutely real. It's absolutely real. Teresa, thank you. And the point that I keep making is the women are saying, we'll go to the FBI. We'll talk to the FBI, knowing that it's 5 years in prison if you lie to the FBI. And Kavanaugh and the Republicans are saying, oh, we don't want to talk to the FBI. And that should tell you everything.
You're listening to Tom Hartman. Visit TomHartman.com for audio and video archives.
It's 15 minutes before the hour, 45 after. We'll be right back with more of your calls and the news of the day here in the home of the political revolution, the Tom Hartman Program. And welcome back. David in Torrance, California, watching us on Free Speech TV. What's on your mind, David?
Yes, I'm wondering why don't we organize a big, huge demonstration against this nomination of Kavanaugh. I mean, I believe this is more important than anything we're going to have.
It's actually, there are two major demonstrations going on right now as we speak. One is at Yale University, where this newest woman is alleging that Kavanaugh assaulted her, essentially, with his pants down. And the law students have shut down the law school at Yale University, number one. And number two, outside Susan Collins' offices, and I don't know if Lisa Murkowski is getting this as well, but Collins has been kind of all over the map on this thing. Outside of her Senate office, the halls are jammed, and apparently all over Maine, her individual offices are being jammed by women who are saying, no, please don't do this.
I've heard about that, both of those demonstrations, but I believe if we can organize a lot larger demonstration, like get a million people in Washington, D.C. This is going to have a huge effect.
Right? Yeah, that would be a good thing. That absolutely would be a good thing. David, thank you for the call. Yes, totally agree. Spot on. Gene in Oaksbury, Pennsylvania, listening on WFTE.
Hi.
Hey, Gene, what's up?
Hi, Tom. I did see you on Bill Maher, and it was such a great show.
Oh,
I laughed, and you were wonderful. Michael Moore.
And
Bill
Catherine
Maher.
Rampell
oh, my
did a
heroes.
Great job.
Yeah, it was really a great show. It really was. Your show moved so fast that I was going to talk about Michael Cohen's. He was speaking to Robert Mueller last week. I'll talk about that, actually.
Sure.
And it kind of got lost in the news. He spoke to him, I don't know how many days last week, but Michael Cohen, very interesting, is that how he met Trump was his uncle was Morton Levine, and he owned a nightclub in Brooklyn in Mill Basin called El Caribe, which is where the mafia would hang out. The Italian mafia and the Russian mafia together would use it as a gathering place. Not only that, they hung out there as a nightclub, but upstairs was an actual headquarters where the Russian mafia conducted their business. And I hadn't heard any of that at all until
how did Donald Trump get introduced into that mix?
Well, Donald Trump sold condos. Michael Cohen became his lawyer when
to the mobsters.
I believe they were introduced, and mobsters wanted to buy condos for cash.
Right,
cash down in Trump Tower, and Trump was more than happy to take the money, with no questions asked. Which
what's your source for this, Gene?
The source, let me think. Well, Wayne Barrett was a wonderful, he was like an unofficial biographer of Donald Trump.
Yeah.
It was actually him, and it was also David K. Johnson, I think, are the two people that are the go-to people as far as Trump's history goes and his first connections with the mafia, the Russian mafia.
Yeah, Michael Cohen's uncle, he owned the club?
Morton Levine, yes.
Morton
and
Levine.
Michael Cohen had a share in the club, and he gave it up when Trump became president.
Wow.
So that connection is very strong, I believe.
Remarkable. Gene, thank you. Thanks for that information. That's solid. I appreciate it. We'll be back with more of your calls in just a moment. It's coming up on 10 minutes before the hour. It's the Tom Hartman Program, the place where smart people get their news. Fair and only slightly unbalanced. We'll be right back. So, back to your thoughts on what's going on. I think, you know, mine are getting pretty obvious. Nancy in Renton, Washington. Hey, Nancy, what's on your mind today?
Well, I'm just really curious why no one's upset that I read this in the Seattle Times.
Mm-hmm.
Both Gorsuch and Kavanaugh went to the same high school.
This prep school?
They, pardon me?
The prep school, was it Holton Arms,
yes,
or something, or
yes,
whatever it is? Wow. I don't think they're the same age, though. Isn't Gorsuch actually younger than Kavanaugh?
But the point is that we're getting our justices from such a narrow...
Oh, I see. Yeah.
Narrow group of people.
Yeah, a narrow strata of society.
Becoming like a brotherhood or a junta or something.
Yeah. Yeah,
I have no idea why people aren't really up in arms about that, or why it's not even discussed.
Yeah, and you see, you know, most of the captains of industry came out of good schools and came from wealthy families. It's harder and harder for average people to catch a break in the United States, and that's a good example of it. Nancy, thanks for, you know, pointing all that back out to us again. Don in Berkeley, California. Hey, Don, what's on your mind today?
Yes, first of all, I saw you on Bill Maher, absolutely loved you.
Thank you.
The woman sitting next to you had made a comment about part of the Mueller investigation. She thinks a lot of it has been spread out. Do you know if that's true? Is Mueller holding everything to himself, or is he passing parts off to the states? When or if the investigation is killed, the states can then all pick it up.
My understanding is it's both. And Catherine Rampell, who is the woman sitting next to me, is a great writer for the Washington Post, or the New York Times, whichever it was. It's the Washington Post, yeah, okay, thank you, Sean. I know that the AG, is it Schneiderman? There's a new AG in New York State. A woman. I'm blanking on her name. I'm sorry, Don. But in any case, the Attorney General for New York State is looking at Trump crimes. The federal prosecutor for the Southern District of New York, which oversees New York City, is looking at Trump crimes. And you know, in the Mueller investigation, I hope that what she said is true. I don't. I've not.
Okay.
Gotten into the weeds to the point that I can say with absolute certainty, but that's my understanding, is what she said was 100% right. Don, thanks for the call. It's great to hear from you. Howard in Indiana. Hey, Howard, thanks for listening to SiriusXM. What's up?
Martin, how you doing?
Good.
One thing I'll throw out after a few days mulling all this through, I believe the crux of the issue may lie more at the doorstep of Senator Feinstein of anybody. She held evidence in that letter for, I guess, 6 weeks, and did not tell anyone about it, mainly the other members of the Senate committee that were going to approve Kavanaugh. I don't think she said anything to them until the last minute. Something this serious, within 2-3 days, she should have them all in a meeting with copies of the letter, said, hey, people, look at this.
My understanding is that she was... Well, I'm not sure what the exact chain of custody of the documents was, but the reality that we know for a fact is that the woman said to her, please do not reveal my identity, and that's why Feinstein sat on it as long as she did. And it wasn't until the press came out and said, this is who this is. This is Dr. Christine Ford, Blasey Ford, that Feinstein said, okay, here it is. And this is not Dianne Feinstein's fault. I get it. You know, the Fox News would like to make this Dianne Feinstein's fault. This is a Brett Kavanaugh problem. Jack in Mendon, Nevada. Hey, Jack, what's up?
Hi, thanks for taking my call. I was listening to one of the callers you had. She was talking about the age of grasping, and it reminded me of a paper I read years ago by a psychologist that talked about you are now what you were then, and it goes back to
You're fading out there, Jack.
Sorry. Bad reception in Minden sometimes. So.
Yeah, now I can hear you.
But
basically, people don't change that much throughout their lives. Is that what you're saying?
No, at age 13, unless there's an epiphany, they use Reagan as an example of the family circle. When he was 13, that was it. Mom stayed at home, cooked, the family circle. When he was a president, we didn't have that. We had broken families and families of all different types of adoptions and separated marriages and remarriages. So there wasn't really that family circle. Plus, the economy, both.
Yeah, so Jack, you faded out again. But, you know, I think I get what you're saying. And I'd like to add to that, by the way. You know, there is this theory, and thank you, Jack, for the call. There is this theory that that people don't change typically throughout their lives. And I know that change is possible. I've changed in pretty dramatic ways throughout my life. And I know a few people who have, but it's difficult. It takes time. It takes reflection. And the fact that it's so rare is why the main plot device of most movies and novels is that the protagonist, the lead character, changes. They have to change for us to love the movie or the novel. And why do we love that? Because it's so rare. But when it happens, it's so deep and consequential. So, you know, is Brett Kavanaugh the same guy he was when he was in high school? Apparently. But, you know, it's going to take a lot more for us to find out. Anyhow, we'll see you tomorrow. Don't forget, democracy is not a spectator sport. Get out there, get active, tag, you're it. See you tomorrow.
You've been listening to Tom Hartman. For audio and video archives, visit TomHartman.com.